Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today is an American journalist based in Italy. Formerly the Rome bureau chief for Newsweek, she now works for the Daily Beast. She's an on-air contributor to CNN and a writer for Scientific American. And for the past 20 years, she's covered crime in Europe, Italian politics, the Vatican, the refugee crisis, and women's issues. Barbie Lazzanedò, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you so much.
Now, you moved to Italy back in 96. What took you there?
I moved to Italy like so many people do for love. I followed my husband at the time there, who got a job.
And did you always intend to be there permanently?
You know, we came for 2 years. The idea was to come to Italy, 2 year contract. He worked for the United Nations, and then we had children, and then I got a job with Newsweek, and then why leave?
But you started actually as a travel writer, didn't you?
I did. I did a lot of travel writing. You know, it was hard because I didn't speak the language initially. It was really hard to try to find my footing as a foreign correspondent. I had been working as a journalist in the United States. But travel writing is the obvious first way to write in Italy. It's very easy to sell travel stories. But then soon I got the job with Newsweek and became a news correspondent, as I was doing in the United States.
So you had worked at home in America covering just the big current affairs of the day.
One of the biggest stories I ever covered was a plane crash in Iowa that was very close to where I had grown up. So I was one of the big, big tragic stories. And I realized at the time how much I liked breaking news and how much I really liked to tell the story as it was developing rather than taking a step back and looking at stories after they've happened.
Mm. Well, one of the biggest stories to come out of Italy recently, and certainly the one that's captured the imagination of people worldwide, is Amanda Knox and the murder of Meredith Kircher. And I know that you have written a book about that. That's called Angel Face, the true story of student killer Amanda Knox. So obviously this was something, a kind of gift. Here was this enormous story waiting to be discovered. It was adapted for a film. Remind us of the facts, as far as we know them, of this case.
Well, the main fact of the murder of Meredith Kircher is that Meredith Kircher's body was found, in her bedroom in the apartment that she shared with Amanda Knox on November 1st, 2007. Door is locked, no blood outside the door. Nobody knows who killed her. And that's the basic and obviously most important fact, that you've got a tragic murder. Amanda Knox initially confessed to being in the house at the time of the murder.
And now she was her flatmate, her roommate.
She was her roommate. Meredith was living with Amanda and two Italian women who were not students. They were paralegals in a town of Perugia. They didn't know each other that well. They hadn't been there that long. This was in November. They had started the semester in September. And so they weren't really close friends and they didn't have a long history together. But we soon learned that they didn't really like each other. Amanda was a little bit too American for Meredith, and Meredith was a little bit too British, I guess, for Amanda. And they'd clashed a little bit, and that was some of the testimony we heard. But Amanda initially confessed to being in the house and accused another man of the murder. And that's when she started really becoming the primary suspect in the murder, because it was quite apparent right away that she had lied, that the man she'd accused had nothing to do with the murder. And then she backtracked on whether or not she'd been in the house or not. But she had a lot of details about the murder that nobody else had at the time. And that's why I think the police focused on her.
So, in fact, somebody has been sentenced to this. This is a man from Ivory Coast, I believe.
That's right. He was a legal migrant. His parents came over across the sea. He wasn't a clandestine immigrant by any means. He had gone to university, studied hotel services, had dropped out of university. He was living with an Italian family who had kind of sponsored him. And he was kind of caught up in the drug scene there, but didn't have any sort of criminal record. He was well known to Meredith and to Amanda and to the people who lived in the apartment below Amanda and Meredith, always affiliated with the kind of low-level drug selling and things like that, supplying of drugs. But he was convicted of the murder as one of three people. He had a separate, what they call in Italy, a fast-track trial, which means he admitted to certain things that he did, not calling the police, not calling an ambulance, things like that. In exchange, he was able to be tried separately, and his lawyers thought that that was the right thing for him, because if there was, as his lawyer said, a black guy with two white people, that the black guy would be the one ultimately convicted. So he was convicted first. Amanda and Raffaele Sollecito, Amanda's boyfriend, they were convicted later on in a longer trial, but they were all convicted as the three authors of the murder. And Rudy Gaudet to this day remains convicted as one of three people who killed Meredith Kircher. So in theory, there are two people still wanted for that crime.
Because, of course, Amanda Knox got off.
That's right. Amanda and Raffaele Solecito were actually convicted twice and acquitted twice. And that last acquittal is the one that counted.
So there seems to be a lot of evidence that the jury must have heard, that the court must have heard, that we, the public, are not privy to.
Well, they did. The trial lasted a long, long time, and there was a lot of testimony. But the problem was, of course, that in the Italian press, it was all reported, but in the Anglo press, whether in the United States or the UK, there weren't a lot of Italian speakers. So Amanda Knox's family, to a large extent, did all the translation, certainly for the Americans, and they picked and chose what information got out and what information was disseminated. And that really skewed the view in the court of public opinion. And the police made such incredible mistakes in the collection of the forensic evidence. And that combined with these unlikely suspects, I think ultimately led to their acquittal and the confusion and the reasonable doubt that set them free.
Mm. As you say, the media seemed to have been hugely influential in this trial. I mean, how much of that had to do with the defendant's control or influence of the press? You were saying that the Knox clan were basically picking and choosing what got out.
They were picking and choosing, especially in the United States. But Italy's court structure, which is a three-tier court structure, lends itself to this sort of manipulation. The jury is not sequestered. They can read the newspaper. I had coffee with one of the jury members for almost every morning, you know, during the trial as a journalist. That's ridiculous that you could even have a conversation with the jury members. They weren't told not to talk to the media. They weren't told not to read the press. And, you know, most of those jurors, especially in the first trial, only spoke Italian. They were reading the Italian press. The Italian press had convicted her. They were completely sure that she and Raffaele Solecito were guilty of the murder. Of course, that swayed the jury. Of course it did. There's no way that a human being could read, you know, the press and not be swayed by it. In the appellate trial, the one in which she was originally acquitted, the jury were a little bit more savvy. I think they were reading a little bit more of the English press, but they were still had complete access to the journalists who talked to them constantly. Mm. But I think the Italian justice system does lend itself to manipulation by the media. Access to jurors is never a good thing if you're a journalist. It's a great thing if you're a journalist, not a great thing for justice.
Yeah.
Though.
And in fact, you had access to both sides as well, both the Knox and the Kircher side.
That's right. You know, I was so impressed by the way the Kircher family handled this terrific, horrific crime, the murder of their daughter. They were so stoic and so elegant, if you can use that word, in their grief. And they didn't seek out the media, and they didn't want to talk to anyone, and they didn't have a story to get across. They just wanted justice for their daughter. And it was such a contrast to the American sort of in-your-face public relations campaign where, you know, if you ask for an interview with one of Amanda's parents, they would say, well, I didn't like the story you wrote last week. I think you're not telling the story we want to be told. So no, you can't talk to them. And that's a very influential way to control the media by controlling access to information and access to sources.
Mm. Did this force you to look at the way the media operates around this kind of circumstance?
Absolutely. You know, I recalled the O.J. Simpson murder trials, O.J. Simpson in the United States many, many years ago. And I remember at the time thinking, wow, that must have been hard as a journalist to cover that because it's such a sensational trial. Then to find yourself in the center ring of a media circus is daunting. Those of us who lived in Italy at the time, those of us who understood the language, we were sort of in some strange way at the epicenter of this media circus. And you felt sort of responsibility. And you also felt very strange when people from all over the world would descend on Perugia to cover the case and you felt like they didn't understand it or that they were too influenced by the Knox family or didn't even mention Meredith Kircher's name at all in their stories. It was frustrating, but it gave me resolve to stay objective, to sort of maintain my theory that Amanda Knox could not be innocent just because of the passport she carried, but it has to be about evidence. And as someone who covered the trial and went to every single hearing in the first and second trials, I really did feel there was enough evidence to convict her, to find her complicit at least, as having a role in this murder.
Mm. And in the book you wrote, of course, this is the theory that you lay out. And you're also one of the few people that has really talked about the victim, about Meredith Kircher. I wonder what the reaction to the book has been.
Well, in the United States, I think people read the book and they either think it's just all fake news and lies, or they read it after they thought that they understood the story and say, oh, well, actually, there's more to this story than meets the eye. I tried very, very hard to stay in touch with the Kircher family without necessarily quoting them and interviewing them, because they didn't want to be quoted in any of the stories. But I maintained contact with them throughout the trial, handing them information as I got it, even, you know, giving them some things that happened in the trial, some details and things like that. I was so impressed by the way they were able to just wait for justice to take its course. And I was one of the first people to interview Meredith's family after they were acquitted, after Amanda and Rafael were acquitted, and the disappointment in their faces that now suddenly the story, the case was open again, and that they thought had been concluded with the conviction was suddenly an open wound once more. And the way they dealt with it was impressive, I thought, and it made me have a great deal of respect for them and their pain.
What about the Knox side?
The Knox family hates me, absolutely hates me. And I got incredibly vile text messages all throughout the trial from Amanda Knox's stepfather. Those who supported her sent me hate mail, hoped, you know, wished upon me the same outcome that Meredith Kircher had, you know, horrific sorts of things. Whenever I had a threat that seemed a little bit strange or too dangerous, I just handed it to the police in Perugia, because I thought, oh gosh, you know, maybe I could be walking down the street and who knows what would happen. There was a lot of anger towards anyone who was trying to be objective, especially if we were American. And there weren't very many Americans who could afford to be objective, because they needed the Knox family on TV or they needed those primary sources.
How much did you have to do with the Michael Winterbottom film that was based on your book?
You know, I consulted on the screenplay. The film was a fictionalized version of a murder case that had similarities to the murder of Meredith Kircher. I went once when they were filming in Siena. I became a good friend, I think, of Michael Winterbottom, who I still maintain contact with. I think he's a creative genius, and really found it interesting to see the sausage making of a film. I found it fascinating. But it did divert quite a bit from the actual case. So in that respect, I think that a lot of people thought, oh, this is going to be sort of a documentary, and it wasn't. So I think some people were disappointed that it wasn't a documentary. Other people were relieved that it wasn't a documentary.
What do you think that it shows us about the Italian justice system? I mean, it sounds completely chaotic.
Well, I think it shows us more about our fascination with death and murder. You know, the slowing down to look at the car accident or whatever it is we all do, the kind of voyeuristic side we all, I think, have on some level. In terms of the Italian justice system, you know, you have to look at the Italian legal system and the justice system through the eyes of some of the big cases they've covered: organized crime, mafia, the Red Brigades, national terrorism, the years of lead. You know, they have a lot of experience dealing with very serious crimes of national terrorism and organized crime. And so you can't discount them. It works for them in a lot of cases. And while it may seem chaotic to those of us in the United States or here in the UK, I think you can't look at the Italian system through the eyes of someone who doesn't live there and isn't Italian. Mm. It works for the Italians.
Well, of course, organized crime is then the focus of your next book, Roadmap to Hell: Sex, Drugs and Guns on the Mafia Coast. This is a horrific book. From sex slaves to drug mules, it's about this huge, intricate web of mafia activity right here in Europe. It's a fantastic exploration of this, brilliantly detailed. You've clearly spent a lot of time with people who are involved right in the very heart of it. Give us the basic premise of the book.
Well, you know, I think the reason I decided to write the book is because I was feeling complicit that I was keeping this great secret of these ever younger women coming across on the migration trail and then being trafficked, showing up on the streets. You know, I've been covering migration in Italy for a very, very long time. And I saw definitely in 2011, 12, 13, an increase in Nigerian women coming across on the boats. And then in 2016, there was a 600% increase in the number of Nigerian women, most of them under the age of 20, who were coming across on the boats. And if you're reporting on migration and you see this happening, and you know, I had a hard time selling these stories to my usual outlets. Nobody in the mainstream press really wants this kind of detail. It's horrifically depressing. And it's complicated and you can't just put it all in a 500-word story. And I felt the book was important to lay it out, to be able to tell the stories of several of the women I had met, and to sort of alleviate some of the pressure I felt in keeping the secret. Because in Italy, everybody knows this is going on. You can talk to an aid worker, a police officer, a nun. Everybody knows these women aren't prostitutes, they're sex slaves. And there's a huge difference.
Mm. Shocking figures. Something like 11,000 Nigerian women crossed the sea last year. 80% of them were thought to be trafficked. Could you tell us how they end up in Italy, what this journey is?
These women are all Nigerian. The women that I focus on and the victims of sex trafficking are almost entirely Nigerian. Every now and then you'll see someone from Ghana or another African nation, but Nigeria is the country, the source country. And what happens is always the same. These young women in Nigeria end up in Benin City or larger places. They've left their villages. They've gone into a larger city to try to have a better life, and they meet someone. And it's usually someone in their church. A lot of these women are devout. And the woman says almost the same thing invariably. You seem special. I'll bet you want more to your life. I'll bet you would love to go to Europe. And the girl, you know, working maybe as a cleaner or in a hair salon or whatever, says, yes, I would. And then the sponsor, the woman who's helping with the trafficking, helping identify the most vulnerable, either because they're beautiful or because they're young or because they're vulnerable without a family member close by, will say, listen, I have a cousin or a brother or a sister. I know someone in Europe that can help you. They're looking for a babysitter. They're looking for a hairdresser. And then the woman says, okay, yes, I'll go. Yes, I'll go. And that's how it starts. Then through a series of smugglers, with the traffickers always paying for the girl's transportation, and the girl always being told, well, you just make sure you promise to pay back these transportation costs when you get to Italy. They say yes. They get on the truck that crosses a desert. They end up stuck in Libya. They get on the boat. But usually, if you ask a woman, a Nigerian woman, when she's been rescued at sea, how much she had to pay, and she says to you, well, I didn't have to pay anything. I'm going to pay when I get there. You know she's been trafficked. Those people who say, well, I had to pay $1,000, $5,000, $7,000 of my life savings to cross the desert and to cross the sea, that's a different phenomenon. That's, we're talking about smuggling there. But the women who have been paid for have actually been sold, and they're going to owe between 30,000 and 60,000 euro once they get to Italy. And the only way they can pay for that is through selling their bodies because they don't have legitimate documents.
And how many people then are involved in that sale? How many hands would she pass through, and where is that money ending up?
Well, the sponsor in Nigeria gets a cut. They pay the smugglers, the people, the physical transportation of these women. Those people get a cut, the smugglers. There's a difference between traffickers and smugglers. The traffickers are more the masterminds. The smugglers are the transportation services. Generally, if she's been sold in Nigeria to someone in Italy, there'll be a couple of middlemen, a couple of people that will make sure she gets out of the Libyan detention centers and make sure she gets on one of the boats that crosses the sea. Then they'll be keeping track of her. All these women end up with a phone number they have to call. If you meet someone on a rescue boat and you say, what are you going to do when you get to Italy? And they say, well, I've got this phone number, and it's written on their hand or sewn into their jacket or whatever. I'm going to call this person. That's where I have the job waiting for me. And it's almost always the same. So you could say two or three people will facilitate these women all the way through. But I was on a company to rescue boat in the Mediterranean. And in one of the particular rescues, there was an older Nigerian woman with five very young Nigerian girls. They had to have been teenagers. And that older woman was shepherding them across the sea. She was not the smuggler, she was the trafficker. And every time I tried to talk to those young girls on the boat, that older woman was right there making sure I didn't say too much. On these rescue ships, whether it's the Italian Coast Guard or an NGO boat, they have phone numbers everywhere that say, you know, if you're coming against your will, if you think you're being trafficked, if someone's treating you wrong, call this number. And those older Nigerian women that are taking them across, make sure that those girls don't have a way to write that number down. Make sure that they're not listening to the talks on trafficking and things like that they give them as a warning. Then once they get into Italy and they get into the asylum process where they have to apply for political asylum, what invariably happens is there are people within those asylum centers, especially the large ones in Sicily, that know these girls are coming, that know that there's someone with five young girls, and they'll very quickly usher them out of there. It's very easy to escape an asylum processing center, a political asylum processing center in Italy. The gates aren't locked. Once you've applied for asylum, you can leave for a few hours every day. Most people take on odd jobs, whether in agriculture or this and that, but inevitably then someone picks them up and takes them to a street, and they're sex slaves.
And another thing, I suppose, that I understand, according to your book, keeps them loyal, so to speak, is fear, supernatural forces, black magic, juju.
Absolutely. The juju curse is a very important aspect of why they don't leave the street. And I think it's also a very important aspect as with regard to why the Catholic nuns seem to be the only ones that can save them, because they consider the juju curse as a pact with the devil, and Catholic nuns know exactly how to deal with the devil. So they can speak to the women and try to get them to give up the juju curse. But the juju curse is something that's very common in Nigeria. A lot of men make their wives take it to keep them faithful. Women will even go to a juju doctor if they're trying to get pregnant and they're having fertility issues. So it's not just used for sex trafficking. But once a woman has taken the juju curse, in which she leaves little bits of her body, whether it's a slice of skin or some hair, fingernails, blood, things like that, she feels bound then by duty to anyone who helps her. And that juju curse, these women, every one that you talk to that's taken it will be afraid that she's going to go mad or that her family's going to die in Nigeria. They're terrified of defying the juju curse. And that's where the Catholic nuns come in, because they know how to fight that. And they know how to make it believable that you can give up, you can fight the devil, as it were.
So the nuns are doing something proactively to try and stop this. How much of a government role, for instance, and how much is the Nigerian government involved in trying to stop it from their end?
Well, the Nigerian anti-trafficking arm has a new director as of a year ago, and she's got a big challenge ahead of her, because that organization had been complicit in some corruption scandals prior to that. So she's trying to do some campaigning to tell girls, listen, there's no babysitting job in Europe for you. There's no hairdressing job. You know, if someone tells you this, this is what it means. But it's going to take a lot, because once a lot of the girls get here, they're forced by their madams to send messages back to their friends in Nigeria to say everything's okay. They're forced to perpetuate the lie. Nigeria hasn't been very successful in keeping people from fleeing, in part because they don't have alternatives in terms of employment and even education to try to combat this desire for a better life. The authorities in Italy, when you look at the fact that 119,000 people came across the sea in 2017, more than 180,000 came over the year before, they've got bigger priorities. They're worried about terrorists on those boats. They're worried about national security. Inevitably, there are a handful of babies whose parents died. They're worried about those unaccompanied minors. So by the time you get down the list to the potentially trafficked women, they're already gone.
Mm. Is there any doubt that this is ultimately mafia-controlled?
Organized crime is a very powerful force in Italy. And whenever you start, if you go from the bottom up, let's say, you find a trafficked woman who is owned by a madam who gives her money to a Nigerian gang, that Nigerian gang is paying off one of the organized crime syndicates. You cannot engage in criminality in Italy unless you have permission by one of the big organized crime syndicates, whether it's through the drug trade, arms trafficking, or people trafficking, or whatever it may be. There's just no way to start a whole new criminal movement unless you've got permission and or are paying protection money or rent for the sidewalk or whatever in the territory. And you look at the highest precedent of Nigerian trafficked women, they're always in the places where there are organized crime mobs, like around Naples, where you have the Camorra, in Sicily, where you have the Cosa Nostra, and in Calabria, where you have the 'Ndrangheta. This is where the primary epicenters for trafficking exist, and those wouldn't be happening unless organized crime syndicates said it was okay. Nothing happens.
But who are the clients? There seem to be so many of these women. There must be even more men who want to use their services.
Well, this is a big blind spot when you're talking about trafficking, or who's buying the sex slave. And there aren't a lot of campaigns right now to educate men who use prostitutes to look out for trafficking victims. And I think that would be a good place to start. I met a lot of Italian men who have used prostitutes. Most of them used prostitutes during their mandatory military years when they were 18 and 19 years old. That's not a thing of the past now in Italy, but a lot of them, that was kind of a rite of passage. Because it's a Catholic country, they don't want to marry a girl with a lot of sexual experience, but yet they don't want to miss out. So prostitution has always been an acceptable way in which to have sexual experiences. But I saw lots of clients that weren't Italian. I saw a van load of Russians once when I was out reporting who had come to this area near Naples, who had rented a hotel suite and just picked up girls and girls and girls. I saw German men coming. I saw Polish men. You know, you very easily tell they rent a car, they drive down in their own cars. You look at the license plates. You look at the traffic on the streets. They're not all Italians. Granted, there are a lot of Italians. Prostitution isn't necessarily taboo in Italy, and men don't necessarily feel shame when they use a prostitute. But these aren't prostitutes. These are victims of sex trafficking. And unless someone explains the difference between those two, I think you're going to see a continuation of this.
Absolutely. I mean, this book is beautifully done. You've got right into the heart of it. You tell hugely personal stories. You've got to know these women and you tell us what's happened to them. And in some cases, you just don't know. They disappear. And I wonder what the emotional impact on you is and on your own security. I mean, you were talking about the fallout after the Amanda Knox book and how you got a lot of hate mail. After this book, I imagine that you're quite high up on hit lists.
Well, I hope not. I hope that's not the case. But, you know, when I started reporting this book, I was looking at the people, the stories I was telling. I was telling stories about 14, 15, 16-year-old Nigerian girls and Catholic nuns primarily, two people that I think I would like to think are more vulnerable than I am. And so I always think if they can be out there and deal with this, you know, I should feel fairly safe. And, you know, to be honest, I'm shining my little pen light on an enormous problem. And I really don't have the arrogance to think I'm going to make any difference. But if someone finds out about it and someone can make a policy change or start looking out for these women when they rescue migrants, maybe it'll make a difference. But I don't think you can be a good journalist or a good reporter if you go in there worrying about what's going to happen to you. You got to tell the story. And I felt especially complicit by not telling the story. And I think, you know, I have teenage sons, and I would see these girls out on the street that were the same age as the girls they were hanging out with in their social lives, and it felt very personal, and it felt wrong to not write about it. And as I said, you know, it's really hard to sell these stories to the mainstream press, so, you know, writing a book is sometimes the best way to do it. And it's a tiny little pen light, but hopefully it's starts a conversation.
Absolutely. It's a conversation I think we all desperately need to be having right now. And you can be better informed if you read this book. It's Roadmap to Hell, Sex, Drugs and Guns on the Mafia Coast. It's by my guest today, Barbie Latsa-Nadu, and it is published by One World. Barbie, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.